Hello and welcome to the menu on Monocle 24. I am Marcus Hippie. This week, where do our Christmas traditions come from? Why is it the likes of turkey and pudding that have become so associated with the celebration? Food historian Annie Gray will explain it all for us.
The Christian church took a lot of the pagan festivals that were around and Christianized them. It happened to Easter and it certainly happened to Christmas. So they bolted on Christmas to this existing kind of stand around and eat too much and light a big fire scenario.
And as Christmas is almost here, we get cocktail recommendations from the award-winning bartender and drinks consultant, Rich Woods.
Something with cranberry or even a red currant in a cocktail, even a, you know, a riff on a cosmopolitan with red currant would work really well because obviously it's a condiment that we would normally associate with this time of year.
And of course we'll hear a dinner soundtrack recommendation too. That is all ahead on this edition of The Menu here on Monocle 24. We start this week's programme with a look at the roots of some of the most common and best-loved Christmas dishes. How did certain foods become so heavily associated with Christmas? And are there some dishes that have disappeared from Christmas tables over the years? And what will we be eating a few decades later? Annie Gray is a food historian who has just released her new book At Christmas We Feast, Festive Food Through the Ages. I spoke to her a bit earlier.
Yes, Christmas was very different. There are continuities. So, I mean, you can go back to pre-Christian times and see continuities in that in the middle of winter, there is a kind of need, I think, especially in Northern Europe, to light a massive fire and stand around it and eat too much and drink too much. And that's a really good way of getting through this very gloomy, horrible period. And it's usually around the midwinter solstice, so the middle of December. And what happened was the Christian church took a lot of the pagan festivals that were around and Christianized them. It happened to Easter and it certainly happened to Christmas. So they bolted on Christmas to this existing kind of stand around and eat too much and light a big fire scenario. So in the medieval period, that's really what it's about. It's about warmth. It's about eating too much. It's about drinking too much. And what you're eating, especially, is very much what's in season and what you can afford as well. So from that point of view, kind of fairly similar. But of course, lots of things that we associate with the modern Christmas weren't around yet. So things like the turkey, the potato, they just haven't been introduced to the country yet. And what gets eaten realistically is lots and lots of meat because it's prestigious, it's expensive, it's associated with the wealthy, and lots of spice and lots of booze and all the kind of things that you use to show off with, really. And around that, you've got the trappings of the medieval Christmas, which tend to be religious. So there are 12 full days of Christmas at that point. Advent was a time of fast, so fish only, no meat products at all. And when you got to the 25th of December, everything went mad for the full 12 days. So that's quite different because now Christmas starts in September and sort of peters out around lunchtime on Christmas Day. And it was a big thing, you know, a big celebration and lots and lots of eating.
So the Christmas we know nowadays, how much did the Victorians have to do with turning it into what it is?
Quite a lot. I mean, I think there's this idea that the Victorians really made the modern Christmas. And I think the Victorians would have disputed that. They thought they were just putting it back to where it should be. So for the Victorians, the Tudors celebrated Christmas properly when it was all about hospitality and Father Christmas, the emblem of Christmas, coming to the door and being feasted and, you know, lots and lots of parties and everything was the good old days. And it was never like that in the Tudor period. But of course, that didn't matter when you were a Victorian looking at it from 200 years later. So the Victorians thought they were putting Christmas back to how it should be, and that should be about hospitality and charity. But they also did introduce new elements, so things like the Christmas tree and the Christmas cracker, notoriously all invented by the Victorians. Well, popularised by them, I should say. The Christmas tree was very much known in Germany prior to the Victorian era, and it was our Germanic royal family that really brought it in and popularised it in the 1840s. And the other thing the Victorians did was to make Christmas much more about families, so much more about children, rather than just getting up raucously drunk and falling over. And they really focused in on Christmas as an idea and indeed as a day as well. So the 12 days were kind of still vaguely in people's minds, but you didn't get them off work anymore. There was no need to down tools for that winter period because most people now were living in towns and cities and working in factories. So for them, it was very much about Christmas. And what you had before the Victorian era was things like plum pudding and 12th cake and mince pies, things that are very much part of our Christmas. And the Victorians renamed them Christmas pudding, Christmas cake. I mean, mince pies stayed the same word, but became much, much more associated with Christmas and much less associated more generally with the winter period than they had been before.
Tell me more about how Christmas dishes came about. There are so many of them we just nowadays associate only with Christmas, but were those things eaten in other parts of the year as well earlier?
They were, yes. And I think it's one of the sad things in some ways about the modern Christmas that we kind of eat mince pies. I mean, the big ones are mince pies, Christmas pudding, Christmas cake, and I suppose turkey as well. I always think with turkey, if we actually liked it, we might want to eat it more than on just Christmas Day. So I'm quite cynical about turkey, but all of those dishes were eaten throughout the winter. So turkey was introduced in the Tudor era, and it became very popular as a winter feast bird. Poultry was seasonal. We don't think of it as seasonal anymore because, of course, you can get chicken all year round. But poultry was seasonal. It was at its best in winter. Normally, at that point, if you were wealthy enough, you'd eat something huge and really, really show off on your table around that Christmas feasting period. So you might have a swan or a heron or a bustard or a crane, you know, really big birds. And when the turkey was introduced, it tasted quite a lot better than most of those, and it was very easily domesticated. So things that you had to run out and chase down kind of went out of fashion versus this great, brilliantly easy to farm bird that then became a kind of Christmas time staple, but not just Christmas, very much about the whole of that winter period, same as goose as well. Then you come to plum pudding, and plum pudding really was a symbol of Britishness. So plum pudding was eaten throughout the year at any celebration. And beef and plum pudding, I mean, if you look at 18th century satires in particular, beef and plum pudding were the symbols of Britishness. So you see them representing the globe, you see them representing Britishness, you see John Bull tucking into beef while Napoleon is tied to a stake in the corner of a room, that kind of thing. So plum pudding was absolutely universal and usually eaten with beef and very much as an accompaniment to it. And the same with mince pies, they were eaten throughout the winter. So a lot of these modern myths we have around these foods, things like stir up Sunday or the idea of maturing the pudding or feeding the cake, you know, they're absolutely unknown in the past because you just cook it and eat it when you wanted it throughout that winter period. So they really didn't become associated purely with Christmas until the 20th century in most cases.
Are there also some dishes that would have lost their popularity, some Christmas dishes that we wouldn't really eat anymore?
There are certainly some regional dishes and some that have gone out of fashion. Many of them are cousins, really, to the plum pudding. So there was a thing called hackin, which was eaten in Lancashire and up in Cumberland. And hackin has a lot of the flavours of a plum pudding, so dried fruit and spices, but it's usually based on beef or sometimes veal. And it's more like a kind of fruity, spicy, rich meatloaf than it is kind of Christmas pudding. Very, very nice, but completely unknown now. There is another thing called pepper cake, again, very much associated with Yorkshire. A lot of the regional traditions survived longer in the north because they were sort of that much further away from London and that much further away from the lure of the southern home counties. So pepper cake was a type of gingerbread, and that was very much something that was associated with Christmas Eve in Yorkshire. And there were a whole host of little things, Yule dogs and poppy dogs and baby cakes and things like that, that sort of crop up from time to time in the literature, very much usually associated with one or two regions. And then there are things like wassail, which has kind of made a comeback among the sort of hipster generation. Mm-hmm. You can, I think, go wassailing in Islington these days. But the idea of wassail was you had a huge vat of, usually it was warmed, post 18th century it was warmed anyway, alcohol. Sometimes there were apples in it, sometimes it was beer based, sometimes cider based. And you'd go around on, depending on where you were, Christmas or New Year or Twelfth Night, and you would wish a happy harvest to your trees or your family or your people. It's one of those very kind of nebulous rituals that was vaguely associated with Christmas, vaguely associated with certain counties, and very much not a thing that people really know about now.
Now, Annie, after we've talked about all that evolution when it comes to Christmas dishes, what do you expect from the future?
It's hard to say. Christmas dinner evolves really slowly because we only have it once a year. And I think it's also very much imbued with a sense of nostalgia and a sense of family continuity. So Christmas dinner a lot of the time is when families come together, and there's a lot of pressure. And I do quite a lot of Christmas talks, and usually I sort of try to get people to move away from turkey and Christmas pudding and, well, turkey mainly. And I normally have older people come up to me and say, oh, I'd love to just go completely off-piste and just do like a really nice roast lamb or something. But I can't, because my grandchildren and my children would hate it. And then I get the younger generation coming up and saying, do you know what? I would really love to just go down the pub on Christmas Day, but I can't because grandma would hate it. So I think there's a real sense, rightly or wrongly, of we have to have continuity because it's a way of marking out time and marking out rituals. So to a large extent, I think Christmas dinner won't change. But of course, there are wider global pressures on the food chain. So I would expect to see us eating less meat. I mean, the average Christmas dinner these days is about 5,000 calories. And that's something that in the world we live in now really isn't sustainable. I think the Christmas pudding is going to die out because we eat it now at the end of the meal and it's very heavy and it doesn't really work there. And for 200, 300 years, it was eaten as part of the main meal and you would finish your meal with ice cream. So that sort of heavy, very British, what we would now call a dessert, really sat much further up the meal, and now people don't understand it, so it's dwindling, and I think the pudding will die out. And I think also we will see a move towards eventually much more sustainable meals, much more sustainable ways of farming, but that won't just apply to Christmas dinner, it will apply across the board.
Just finally, Annie, before I let you go, I wonder, what are your Christmas dinners like nowadays?
Do you know what? I haven't eaten a traditional, in inverted commas, Christmas dinner since I left home when I was sort of 18. So we've done all sorts of things. If we have people over, a lot of the time, I will suggest that everybody cooks a dish. So I just say, tell me what ingredients you want. And then we all cook together all morning. And then we all eat whatever we fancy. I mean, one year we did mutton with caper sauce and Hasselback potatoes and things like that. Last year I had pizza, which was absolutely brilliant because I felt it got there with the Christmas tradition. There was a great big fire. It's an outdoor pizza oven. And then a couple of pizzas, one of which was a sort of riff on a stuffing pizza and one of which was ham and pineapple because I am a child of the 80s. And I think this year I'm probably going to do pizza again because it was just a really nice thing to do. And it's something I love doing. There's a real kind of sense of getting involved in the cookery, making the dough from scratch, doing it all together, planning it, executing it. And if we have people over, great, they all love pizza. And if we don't, well, say what? We'll have pizza, drink some wine, and then watch terrible television all afternoon.
Food historian Annie Gray there, and her new book, At Christmas We Feast, is out now. Let's next continue with this week's food and drink headlines. Here is Monocle's Charlie Field McCourt.
Thanks, Marcus. Omicron has hit the hospitality industry as cities from London to New York are closing their doors because of the variant. Restaurants and bars are facing another uphill battle against the pandemic, as staff shortages as well as reduced customer numbers affect their business. In times of crisis like this, government support will prove vital to retain our all-important dining culture. Next up, two of Champagne's leading producing cooperatives have agreed to team up in a major merger for the sector. Nicolas Fouillat and Castel Nau represent over 6,000 growers and nearly 3,000 hectares, which is about 9% of the Champagne vineyard. Their teaming up will make them one of the biggest players in the industry, a partnership that looks set to be a sparkling success. Over to Greece now, where the world's third biggest producer of olive oil is suffering after the year's warm temperatures. The sought-after Greek variety of extra virgin olive oil is renowned, but the EU Executive Commission has warned in a new forecast that production looks set to fall in the coming years. It's another blow for agricultural producers and consumers alike, and all the more reason to fight back against the climate crisis. And finally, we can hardly believe it, but the resurgence of an unlikely cooked meat is well and truly affirmed. Sales of Spam have hit a record high for the seventh year in a row. Hormel, the company that makes the iconic brand, delivered record sales of $3.5 billion in the 3 months to the end of October. And this week, their shares rose by almost 6% in New York. Valuable commodity indeed. That's all for this week. Back to you, Marcus.
Thanks, Charlie. You are listening to The Menu on Monocle 24. And finally today, as Christmas and the New Year are nearly here, it's a good moment for some cocktail recommendations and for some tips for saving time when making them. For that, I was joined a bit earlier by the award-winning bartender and drinks consultant Rich Woods. He co-owns Scout London, which has regularly made it to the list of the world's best bars. Let's hear what he had to say.
I've seen a lot of pine in drinks at the minute. It's something that's been around, obviously, for years. It's something that's been around in aromatics. And let's not forget that cocktails are a distant relation to perfume. It's essentially aromatics distilled into alcohol. These are obviously just consumed rather than just sprayed on yourself. Pine is quite, has been around for a long time. Likewise with frankincense and myrrh and oud. But these are now, I see them quite a lot in spirits as additions of flavour. Pine being one of the most common, Siberian pine or fir needle, pine needle. In non-alcoholic sodas, in spritz can style drinks, and also in spirits. So these are quite popular. They also are great if you're mixing them with a Prosecco, for example, and a long spritzy drink. Great for the season.
Sounds very good. So if we think about, you know, that flavour, pine, for example, what would you recommend? Give us some cocktail recommendations for Christmas, for example.
Okay, a dark spirit cocktail is always good for the winter because it's quite warming. So something along the lines of an old-fashioned or a Manhattan. You know, you can do your own home hack, make your own mince pie liqueur, potentially, and just top it up with soda. Doesn't actually take a lot. You just need to find some mincemeat. You know, it's on the, they're on the shelves at the minute all over the supermarkets. You just need to infuse it in a dark spirit, such as whiskey or a brandy. Leave it in a non-sealed container, like an ice cream container or a jam jar. Leave it to infuse overnight and then filter it through a coffee filter. And you've got this really nice, sweet, dark, super lush kind of mince pie flavoured liqueur. And you, again, a shot of it in a champagne glass, top it with champagne or Prosecco, and you've got this delicious ingredient. And you've made it yourself.
That's amazing. Can you give us some more recommendations?
In terms of what to make?
Yeah, for Christmas, for example.
Sure. I mean, obviously, you know, clementines are abundant at the minute. You see them on the fruit and veg stalls. If you're fortunate enough to find any with the leaves still on, give the leaves a bit of a wash. Again, just break them as you would tear a mint leaf, infuse them into a bottle of gin overnight, filter them. You've got yourself a nice little clementine-infused gin. And then top it up with tonic. Bob's your uncle. There you go.
Wow.
Really simple, but so fragrant. And, you know, if you're fortunate enough to find a clementine tree in your garden or in a neighbour's garden, obviously, again, wash the leaves. But this is the forage ingredient, something that I've picked, you know, all through the season.
A couple of great recommendations for Christmas over there. I'm wondering, for us who haven't bought Christmas presents yet for everyone, if we go to shops, you know, what kind of spirits, for example, would you recommend? What to buy for your closest ones?
I mean, if again, I'd stick to, because of the season, dark spirits. I have a particular favourite brandy at the minute. It's not a cognac, it's not an Armagnac, it's a blend of Armagnacs and cognacs. It's a brandy called Seven Tails. It is absolutely delicious. It's at the bottom of a price point for a cognac. As I said, it's not a cognac, it's a brandy, but it is super delicious. If I was looking for a light spirit, there's a brand on the market called Sipsmith. They do a cacao and orange, which is in season again. It's only around sort of 2 or 3 months of the year. They remove it from the shelves, obviously come springtime, and then reintroduce it in the wintertime. But it's a great sort of seasonal riff on a gin, and you can mix that into a, you know, a martini or a gin and tonic.
What are your thoughts about pairing cocktails with food? I'm wondering, still thinking about Christmas now, is there something that would work, for example, with turkey?
I go a little bit more savoury. Not everyone's cup of tea, but something maybe like a Cosmopolitan. It's light, it's a little bit fruity. The cranberryness, the bitterness and the dryness of the cranberry would work really well with the savouriness of the dish. I wouldn't go with anything too sweet, so I wouldn't go necessarily with an old-fashioned. I would go more along sort of the drier notes, so something with cranberry or even a, you know, red currant in a cocktail. Even a, you know, a riff on a Cosmopolitan with red currant would work really well because obviously it's a condiment that we would normally associate with this time of year.
Is there a way of saving time also? I'm wondering, you know, quite often our Christmases, for example, seem to be quite busy. Is there something you can do to save time? Can you pre-make cocktails?
Yeah, you absolutely can. I've been pre-batching cocktails for almost a decade. For me, it's one of two things. It gives consistency. If you're in a bar and, you know, I've worked in and owned bars myself, it's that consistency that whatever time of the day you're having this drink, you can have it tasting exactly the same, whether it's the first drink or the last drink. And it's also speed. So absolutely, you can batch. Obviously, make sure it's kept in the fridge. If a drink contains alcohol, alcohol is a preservative, so it would last longer. If it's non-alcoholic, obviously it doesn't last quite as long. But it is possible to keep a drink, a batch cocktail in the fridge for sort of 4 to 6 weeks, sometimes 8, depending on the ABV of the drink.
What kind of containers do you recommend?
Obviously sterilised, so glass bottles, ice cream containers. I wouldn't put anything in sort of a plastic water bottle, especially with anything with acid in it, just because it erodes. But anything like an old wine bottle, make sure it's washed out and cleaned out, and then just refill it with your cocktail.
Well, let's talk about another big celebration, the New Year's, not that far away either. What are your top recommendations for the 31st?
You've got to see in the New Year with champagne, haven't you? So again, I would go something spritzy, maybe a riff on an old-fashioned champagne cocktail. I don't drink that many champagnes, if I'm honest, but obviously New Year's Eve is, you know, one of those rare exceptions that you've got to toast in the New Year, especially this New Year. I feel like it deserves a double celebration.
What about in terms of cocktails, if you want some variation, not only champagne for that evening?
Again, I would go maybe... My all-time favourite drink is a martini. So maybe, for me personally, it would be a dirty gin martini, but it's not everyone's cup of tea, but that would be my first drink, I think, of the New Year.
Well, looking ahead to the festive season, we are shopping things for our home bars, if we have them. What should you look for this time round?
You know, home entertaining has been on the rise for the last 5, 6, 7 years. In the last 18 months, more and more people have bought more and more things for the home bar just because of the circumstances that we're in. It's not uncommon now to walk into a department store or even a big supermarket and see parts of aisles dedicated to home entertainment. So you've got cocktail shakers, bar spoons, you know, measuring equipment, fancy martini glasses. It's the resurgence that we saw. Well, we didn't see it ourselves, but it's the resurgence that was around in the 1920s, 1930s. Home entertaining is on the rise, and I think people like to have that more experiential experience, something that lives just beyond going out for a drink with a friend.
Why do you think that is, by the way? Is it COVID? Is it pandemic related? We're just spending more time at home and actually want to invite some other people over there as well.
I think it's shown us that we can do it. I mean, I think, you know, I certainly have a lot of friends pre-COVID. They used to go out 3 or 4 times a week. And obviously 3 or 4 times 2 or 3 friends, you know, all of a sudden their money mounts up. But they've realised that actually, do you know what? I can have as much fun at home, entertaining and kind of having a good laugh with my nearest and dearest and not go out and spend as much money as you would have done. So I think working in the hospitality sector myself, we've noticed a downturn in people coming out. This time of year is slightly different because it's the festivities. And obviously last year we didn't go out as much. But I think people are more aware, certainly with things like social media, they're more aware of what you can do at home, whether it's education or tutorials online of, you know, how to make your favourite dishes or how to make your favourite drinks. And people are just more savvy. They just want to have a good time.
What do you think are the essentials for home bars then? What do you need over there?
A few years ago, if you'd asked me this question, I would say, you know, if you couldn't get your hands on a cocktail shaker, use an old jam jar with a lid and you can use that. You know, you could use a tea strainer instead of a cocktail strainer. But as I said, there are so many shops now that you could walk into and buy pieces of cocktail equipment. And even this time of year, you go out and you can buy a gift box of a bottle of gin with 2 glasses and a cocktail shaker. So they're in abundance. But my bare essentials would be a martini jug or a shaker, a measure if you needed to, just so you could measure your perfect measurement of a spirit, and a bar spoon and a strainer. They are the basics. And you can buy them pretty much anywhere now.
And what's your top recommendation if you want to make things a bit easier, a bit more exciting when you look at some other things you can buy from those shops?
Well, I mean, if you wanted something that's, you know, a home hack, but make yourself some amazing cocktails, I'd recommend buying my book. But you can, you know, otherwise, again, there's so many tutorials online. But I would say the simplest thing to start with is a cocktail shaker, a martini glass, a stirrer and a jigger. And then you can start anything. You can start from the basics.
So we've covered the New Year's, we've covered the Christmas. I guess we should quickly talk about January, which may be dry for some people.
Yep.
Any mocktail recommendations?
Yeah, I mean, do you know what? I mean, 5, 6, 7 years ago, we started to see an increase of non-alcoholic spirits coming into the market. Fast forward, and there are so many things. There's, you know, you've got non-alcoholic gins, non-alcoholic rums, non-alcoholic vodkas, which are very weird because not many vodkas have a great deal of flavour. So it's quite unusual to try something that's a non-alcoholic vodka. There are, however, starting to come out a lot of non-alcoholic aperitifs and digestifs, which are really interesting because this is the spirit category that has the more dominant flavours. So you've got sort of the bitterness, the dryness, the harshness, the fruitiness. So there's something beyond just trying to replicate the juniper notes of a gin without the alcohol. And let's not forget, alcohol carries flavour. So it's a lot harder to replicate. But I think if you look at drinks like Three Spirit, a beautiful non-alcoholic ingredient, you can buy it in the shops. They have 3 different variations. And this is great with a splash of tonic water. Great highball.
Rich, just finally before I let you go, I'm wondering, what have you lined up for the new year? What's happening in 2022 for you?
You know, I'm a kind of an all or nothing person. I like to run around at 100 miles an hour. So if I've not got anything on, I'm bored. So I'm in the process of writing my second book. So the first book was just simply called The Cocktail Guy. The second book is as yet untitled, but that will be a lengthy process. It's about 9 months to write. I'm also starting a subscription service. So it's a monthly subscription service whereby guests can sign up and I send them sort of every month a box containing either an element or a cocktail that I'm creating at the moment. And it's simply just called What I'm Making and What I'm Drinking, because it's a question I'm always asked. What am I making? Where can I buy it? can I pay for you to make me this beautiful bottle of something? And so it just, I thought, why not just try a subscription service and see what people think? So yeah, it's going to be international as well. Yeah, it's going to start early next year.
And one more question, actually, looking ahead to 2022. What's happening in the cocktail front? How much innovation is there still taking place?
There's a lot. I mean, you know, you'll hear a lot of bartenders say that we take a lot of inspiration from the kitchen. You know, we are closely related, but we are eons away from being at the same level as a lot of the top chefs. But I think, again, we saw a few years ago a lot of bars kind of taking themselves a little bit too seriously. And I think now, and certainly over the last 18 months, people are now starting to take a little bit more of a back foot and say, do you know what? It's just about good quality entertainment. People come out as a means of escape. It's not just about going out and having a drink like it used to be. It's about going out and removing yourself from your daily lives. And I think more and more bars are starting to still take themselves seriously, but with an element of just enjoyment. You know, people are out just to relax. Everyone deserves to relax right now. So that's what we'll see. A lot more sort of downplayed formal, but I guess what I would call informal hospitality. The level of hospitality is still there. It's just not as stiff as it used to be.
Rich Woods there. And that's all for this edition of The Menu. Remember that we are back with a new episode again on Friday at 20:00 London time. That's at midday if you're listening in Los Angeles. Meanwhile, do check out our menu spin-off show Food Neighborhoods for great recipes. This show was co-produced by Charlie Filmacourt and Sophie Monahan Coombs and edited and mixed by David Stevens. I am Marcus Hippi. Once again, we finish this program with a dinner soundtrack recommendation. Here is Holly Day Sidewinder with Leo. Thanks for listening.